I'm John Kroll. The Great American Read is in full swing. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about how libraries use programs such as this to encourage and foster a love of reading. We also will talk about the sheer joy of reading. My guests are Indy Library Director of Public Services John Helling, Carmel Librarian Christy Walker, and Kokomo Librarian Lisa Phipps. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the Great American Read and about libraries and, frankly, just about reading itself and the joy of reading. If you would like to join the conversation, and I would encourage you to do so, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Indy Library Director of Public Services John Helling, Carmel Librarian Christy Walker, and Kokomo Librarian Lisa Phipps. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to have you here. So we'll just start by going around the horn here. And I'll start with the person closest to me here, with Lisa, about how each of your respective libraries is marking the Great American Read, what things you are doing specifically.
Some of the things that we're doing are asking our readers to vote and see what they liked best of those 100. We are already planning a Howard County Reads, which is our one read, one book, one community read. And it was already focused on Frankenstein, so that was very fortunate for us.
Made the list.
Yes, we're like, yeah. So we will be having a lot on Frankenstein in general. And so anywhere we can put displays, where we can encourage it through our book discussions, we have a book around the block where people coming up this summer can walk around downtown Kokomo, learn about books, and get their exercise in. So any way we can squeeze it in, we're squeezing it in.
Christy.
Up at the Carmel Clay Public Library, we have a full slate of programming that we're planning related to the Great American Read. We're going to be having a photo booth both at the library and at some local community events where people can pose with their favorite book from the Great American Read list. We're going to be having a scavenger hunt along Main Street in Carmel's Arts and Design District. That'll be running this week through June 30th. A number of Read the Book, See the Movie programs where patrons can visit the library and see films that were based on books from the Great American Read list. A number of fun contests, a book cover redesign contest, some literary character costume contests, both for humans and adults. We will also be having some guest speakers talk about some
of the titles.
Wait,
I probably ought to correct something. You said humans and adults.
I thought we were adults. Adult humans as pets. We're actually going to be having a dog division of that contest. Right. So patrons will be able to come in themselves in costume as well as with their canine companions, which should be a lot of fun, something different that we haven't ever done at the library before. And it'll be culminating at the end of the summer in a block party that we'll be having in front of the library on August 11th. So a lot of fun things going on up in Carmel.
John.
So we're folding kind of our Great American Read activities into our larger adult summer reading program in general. So we have a pretty robust slate of offerings for people to do this summer. We're having book clubs all over town, not just at the library. You can actually go to a brewery and talk about books in the Indianapolis Public Libraries program. We're doing things at Newfields. We're doing things at the Sky Garden at Eskenazi. So there's all kinds of things going on, and each one of those book club discussions will feature aspects of the Great American Read.
So this is a point, and we probably ought to explain. The Great American Read is an 8-part series that is going to be appearing, and at the heart of it is this list of 100 books that they're novels, works of fiction, that is a, I cannot think of any other way to describe that list than eclectic. You know, that it literally, I mean, it's the kind of thing that only a monkey or a committee could have assembled. But it's fascinating, and it's a fascinating exercise. I'm going to put everybody on the spot, starting with John here. Out of the 100, they ask you to take the quiz. I know that Lisa mentioned that that you're encouraging. Out of the 100, how many have you read? Have you taken the quiz?
I have not taken the quiz. I'm going to be honest, live on the radio, I have not taken the quiz yet. I need to get on it.
Okay. How about you, Christy?
51 of the 100.
51.
Which is perhaps shameful for a librarian.
Yeah.
Better than 50%.
It's odd. I mean, it does kind of expose the gaps in your reading, you know, when you do it. How about you, Lisa?
46. I'm not a librarian, technically. I'm a former journalist, but I do director of marketing. But
okay.
I am a huge reader. Huge reader.
Okay, yeah. And I did it, you know, before I came down here and came in at 60, but I was shocked. It's like almost any of the, you know, like the Outlander series and all of that, that seems to have flown by me. I was strong in the, you know.
The classic.
Yes. The Great American novel contenders and all of that. Although even there, I thought it was a little interesting that you know, some of the choices from some of the writers, like we don't have Adventures of Huckleberry Finn from Mark Twain. We have Adventures of Tom Sawyer instead. There's no Faulkner. Lisa, you were saying,
I know, I was like, I wanted Faulkner in there. They got my Hemingway, but yeah. My Faulkner, I was like, what? And yet I have 50 Shades of Grey, no Faulkner, what?
Yeah. And is that part of the appeal of this, is that the, you know, I mean, everybody comes out with lists. I think at the turn of the century, Random House did a famous list of the 100 greatest books of the 20th century that, you know, as soon as they released it, everybody was attacking and vilifying. Is that part of the parlor game, the appeal of this? John, you're nodding your head here.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. I think it's part of demonstrating to people that, you know, the canon, so to speak, is not something that's set in stone. And just because it's new and just because it's fun to read doesn't mean it's also not great. So it really opens the door, in my opinion, to people who may have been shut out of that conversation in the past, to include things like 50 Shades, which I personally really disliked, but a lot of people really liked. So, you know, we like to make that, you know.
Yeah, that one made it into my Life is Short pile.
Exactly. You've got a finite amount of books to read, and that wasn't going to be one of them for me.
So I'm going to ask, with exercises like this, where we're, you know, there's a concerted effort to get everybody reading the same thing. I ask a simple question, but I don't think there are simple answers to it. I'll start with Christy, but I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts. What's the value of it?
I think something that makes this particular initiative interesting is that it's not actually that prescriptive. Having the list of the 100 titles and ultimately narrowing them down to the top 10 and the best loved novel, I think, as John mentioned, it's the fact that we're not saying this is the book that's the best that everybody should be reading because it's good for you. This is not the literary equivalent of kale that we're trying to achieve here.
Eat your vegetables here, yeah.
Right, that you're getting this list and getting a conversation started with people about what are the books that you've loved the best? What are the books that have been the most significant in your life? And I think that's a slightly different conversation than these more prescriptive lists or these more prescriptive titles that we've seen in the past. We're getting this conversation started with individuals about what were the books that were meaningful to you. And I think that's when we see those surprises cropping up on the list, because one person's great read is something that meant something deeply to someone else and is something that a third person may just turn their nose up at. So I think that really initiates a very interesting and very unique conversation.
Lisa.
And I will have to second what she said in that, you know, I think a lot of people were turned off in reading because years ago we did give this, you must read, you have to, you know, to be a real reader, you must have read these 25 classic books or whatever. And a lot of people were put off by that. And what we like to push is reading. Love what you love. And so that's why I do like the variety, although the 50 Shades was not my cup of tea. But I do like the variety. And you know what else that 100 list shows, in my opinion, is the different generations. And so I think that's important, too, because we couldn't ignore the younger generations who want that Game of Thrones series in there that, you know, my generation wouldn't have necessarily put in there, or my mom's generation wouldn't have put in there. And so this list to me, even though at first I thought, I don't understand some of this, and then I think I took that approach of, you know, you don't want the kale. This is a full-service menu for people. You get a little bit of everything.
John.
I think it goes right hand in hand with public libraries' mission in general, which is just to give people the opportunity to explore whatever their path is and for them to curate their own path. I would echo exactly what was just said. There's no syllabus that you have to step through in order to become, quote unquote, well-read. I think this opens it up to the idea of there are a lot of ways to do that, and everybody is free to create their own way.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Great American Read today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Particularly like to hear what books you think should have been on the list. If they're not there, which ones on this list are your favorites and why? Has discussion started about this already? Are you getting calls, people involved? Lisa, you're nodding your head. That's dangerous because that means I'll call on you.
It started just with the librarians. As soon as the list came out, it was like, oh, my gosh, yay, this was on there. Oh, my gosh, that was on there. Even the librarians themselves have their favorite genres and authors. So it started just as soon as the librarians saw it. So as soon as the patrons start seeing it, they're doing the same thing we're doing, like, they're questioning, and then they're also reminded, oh, I did love that book when I read that in American Lit in college or whatever. And I think it helps people start discussing books, which is always a good thing, because there have been many books that I have read simply because I've been in a book discussion or I've heard about it, and I'm like, I think I should check that out. So I think just talking about it is half the battle.
John.
I couldn't agree more. I know I've been in several conversations where I was approaching a book that, you know, I had tried and didn't like, and I talked to somebody who did like it, and they were able to give me a toehold into, well, here's what you may not have seen your first time through. Try it again and look at, you know, this character or this theme. And it really allows me as a reader to approach it in a different way, and it expands my ability to enjoy books when I talk about that kind of controversy. I know, in my personal opinion, it's not that we talk about these lists because there is one definitive ranking that we're trying to achieve. It's more the fun is in the discussion, and the fun is tossing out an idea and seeing how other people respond to it.
Christy.
And what books people have an emotional connection to in the conversations.
Good or bad?
Correct. I think for the purposes of this, we're more likely to see books that touch people in a positive way. As I've said to my colleagues who, like Lisa, were appalled to see 50 Shades of Grey on the list, I guess we don't really know how many relationships were saved for people who read 50 Shades of Grey and were inspired in ways that maybe we can't imagine.
Really talk about on the radio without bringing the FCC into our lives.
But I think it's also inspiring to see that there are a wide range of age groups represented in the titles. One of my favorite titles from the list was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and the Narnia Chronicles. And I think that that can start conversations with people who can think about titles that really were significant to them when they were young, as well as titles that have been important to them as they're adults.
So out of this, there's been a discussion, obviously, even within the library circle. I'll make everyone... What's the one title that has gotten the most votes that shouldn't be on the list among the librarians? The most head shakes here. This is like a classroom. Everybody's avoiding eye contact except Christy. She made the mistake of looking over here.
I think it's a title that's already been mentioned the most as part of our conversation today.
Oh, it's 50 Shades?
Yes.
50 Shades, is that, John, is that your...
I have to agree, and I just want to make sure I mention it's not because of the subject matter. I think everybody I've talked to just really thinks it's a poorly written book. I'm probably going to get roasted by someone when I say that, but that's been the consensus of the people that I've
talked to. It struck me in looking at the list, there are several titles that could vie for that. I mean, you got, for example, the James Patterson books, and there's a huge debate about whether he even writes those.
That's true. It's a brand.
That basically he's got a, you know, slaps his name on it. He's got a factory of writers who works on these things. Are those the two big ones, or are there any others?
They were for me. I am not a James Patterson fan. So I was like, oh, no, because it is just a commercial machine. And I like really good writing. I don't care about the subject matter as long as it's well written. And that's my personal preference.
Well, and I think the thing, at least for me, that was somewhat is there is so much really great writing being done in that genre
right now
that didn't make its way on to the list. If you're just joining us, we are talking about The Great American Read today on No Limits. My guests are Indy Library Director of Public Services John Helling, Carmel Librarian Christy Walker, and Lisa Phipps from the Kokomo Library. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about The Great American Read today. It's an eight-part series that is in full swing right now that celebrates reading. The centerpiece is really a list of 100 books that involves a quiz. It's going to involve vote. We're talking today about how libraries here in Indiana are working with The Great American Read to promote and foster a love of reading. My guests are Indy Library Director of Public Services John Helling, Carmel Librarian Christy Walker, and Lisa Phipps of the Kokomo Library. If you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So I asked the question about which one didn't belong on the list. What are the books that so far people seem to be the most excited about seeing on the list?
I would say we have a lot of people who are very glad to see Jane Austen. I think that the women of the world might have revolted in a huge way if that had not been on there. And I think people were glad to see a good mix, because there are people who really are sci-fi fans, and they've gotten, you know, some representation on this list. And you know, then there are people who are in the classics, and I love my Hemingway, and it's right there for me. So I think that there's at least one book on there for each person. I would happily say that and easily say that without feeling wrong about it. But I think that's my favorite part, is that depending on your genre, depending on your age, you're going to find at least one book on there that is your great American read.
Okay. John.
Yeah, I firmly agree. There are so many points of entry in the list. I mean, it's just impossible for anybody not to find something. I think I was most happy to see A Confederacy of Dunces on there, just personally.
We've got a Facebook message that's going to take issue with you in a minute.
Oh, no. Well, okay. I'll say that was one of those books that took me literally four tries to get started on and appreciate. So that is one where I started it, put it down, started it, put it down, talked to somebody who loved it, started it again, and really, really got into it. So that, for me, is a perfect example of what this kind of a list can do.
Christy.
I'm with Lisa, where I think it's nice to see genre fiction represented, to see a title like Dune, to see Game of Thrones on the list, to see some of these titles that don't make some of the traditional kinds of lists, some of the newer titles that people are really interested in that aren't necessarily going to be on some kind of recommended reading list or a list of classics. But to see something like Lonesome Dove on a list with To Kill a Mockingbird, I think is really inspiring and really gives people who enjoy genre fiction a sense that those titles are important and significant also.
We're talking about The Great American Read here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Rex has done and find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. And Rex is going to stir some things up here, particularly with you, John. He says, I'll be happy to read 50 Shades of Grey if you don't make me read A Confederacy of Dunces again. Charon. Make the case for it. Take issue there with Rex.
So I don't know if Rex was able to get traction on that book and really get a good way into it, but the reason why I liked it after I had started reading it is because it builds on itself so well. And spending time with that character, Ignatius J. Reilly, first you hate him, and then he gets funny, and then you really, really get just a good sense of what motivates him as a unique, really strange individual. So I don't know how to describe A Confederacy of Dunces better than, like, it's a complete self-contained universe where everything is in perfect orbit and everything just ties up in a nice little bow at the end. It's a gorgeous book.
I remember reading that when I was in New Orleans, and I will say eating,
that's the perfect place to read
eating Cajun food and having a little bit of beer does make the experience.
Yes.
it heightens your passion. Other books like that, are there other books where people are just sort of scratching their heads because they were too hard to read? I mean, I noticed that, Dostoevsky makes the list.
War and Peace.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with him. I've picked it up and read and put it down and picked it up. I don't know how many times. I promise I will read it one day, maybe. So it's one of those books that has just taken me so much. I want to read it. I enjoy it once I get in it, but it's so long. And, you know, it's one of my Achilles heels on that list.
And I think that's one of the great things about a list like this, though. We see these titles in front of us, and I'm guilted by the fact that I've only read 51 of them. And I start looking at the list and thinking, what ones do I want to have a go at? And to hear conversations like this, even a conversation where Rex is saying, I couldn't stand this book, and John is saying, I love this book, to hear that kind of tension about a title makes me more inclined to pick it up now. Whereas before, I might have thought, oh, too long, life's too short.
What is the, I mean, is part of it here that the, I'm trying to think how I want to frame this question. What do people feel most strongly about? The books they love, or in Rex's case, the books they despise?
In my experience, I think people are equally passionate about either, and they're ready to take up and tell you why this is the best book you'll ever read, and they're ready to take up and say, don't waste your time on this. This was garbage. But that's exactly what starts conversations, and that's exactly what, you know, you're supposed to do with a list like this, is pick it apart and talk about it and get exposed to new ideas.
I'd have to agree, because that's how I was with Catcher in the Rye. First time I started reading it, I was like, oh my God, I hate this character. I hate him so badly. But then I was talking to Patty Gausch, who was an editor for years, and she was talking about the voice behind that book. And so I read it looking for the voice, and oh my gosh, it has brilliant voice, nailed to the T. But content, I still don't really enjoy the book because he's annoying. But at the end, you find out why he's so annoying and why his issues stem from where they do. But it is one of those things that if you just take a look at it in a different way, sometimes you get a totally different view from it. And I think that's always good to challenge ourselves as readers. You know, even if it's Game of Thrones, if that's something challenging for you because you don't like that genre, at least try it. See what happens.
How much of this, because, you know, what you just related spurs a thought in that, how much of this is also generational, the responses? Because, I read Catcher in the Rye when, like a lot of people, I was a young man. And at that time, coming-of-age stories really spoke to me powerfully because I was coming of age at that point, less so now than that. That there are different kinds of stories speak to me in ways. Doesn't mean I can't read them, but I read them with a different kind of eye. Are we finding generational splits on this? People saying, oh, you know, I can't understand why that book made it and this one didn't. John, I'll go with you.
I think to a certain extent, yeah, there's a generational split. I also think just sometimes it depends what point in your life you pick up a certain book. I Lord of the Rings is on the list. I read it for the first time in high school. I read Lord of the Rings probably once a year, the whole series in the wintertime. But I don't know if I would pick that book up today, having never read it if I would still enjoy it. Game of Thrones is an example of something I thought I would love. It's going to be great. I love Lord of the Rings. I love epic fantasy. Tried to read Game of the Thrones. Game of Thrones, couldn't stand it. Couldn't do it. I don't know why. It may be because your taste is more open as a young reader. You don't know what you like yet, and so you're open to more things. But I do think it heavily depends just where you are in your life when you pick up a certain book.
Christy.
Maybe if I can find a child who's read War and Peace and kind of. Oh, I do think that you bring a different perspective to books depending on when you read them. I mean, for those of us who were adults when the Harry Potter titles came out and yet enjoyed those, that's been an interesting experience. Working in libraries, we've seen people grow up who were Harry Potter readers and want to transition to something else, and being able to have conversations with them about, I enjoyed Harry Potter when I was 10, I'm 25 now, I'm looking for something to read, what might you recommend? So I think that it does make a difference.
And they've read, by the way, the entire series like 12 times between 10 and 25.
And can quote things and, yes, have favorite characters and know which Hogwarts house they would be in. So I do think it makes a difference. I don't know if adults are maybe more inclined or willing to say titles that they don't like, or if kids feel more free to do that, or if adults are less inclined to say what title they really loved and was significant to them. And maybe children are more free with those kinds of feelings related to reading.
I think sometimes adults feel like, uh-oh, I haven't read all of these. You know, and they feel a little guilty because what they weren't required to read in high school and college kind of just stayed on the shelf. But I do think that on the end of the children, I think that it's wonderful that they put things like Harry Potter series and the Game of Thrones, the Hunger Games, which I was glad to see because it's the quality of writing again that I care about. But I think it's just a matter of let's reach everybody. And if those books speak to you, whether you're 60 and love Harry Potter or 6 and love Harry Potter, I think that says that's a good book. If that many generations like that book, it's a sign of a good book.
Well, it's amazing. And I normally don't do this, but I remember earlier in my life, I was the executive director of what is now the ACLU of Indiana. And my first exposure to the Harry Potter books was when I started getting calls saying that, people were trying to ban them. And I hadn't, my children at that time were too small really to be readers themselves, although my daughter became one of those Harry Potter fanatics and has read the entire series multiple times. But I remember as soon as I started looking at this and I thought, wait a second, someone after 40 years or more of studies, finding that Johnny and Janie don't read or don't read enough, someone has figured out a way to tell a story that not only gets these young people to read, but gets them to show up at a bookstore or a library at 12:01 a.m. on the day the book was going to be released so that they can get it right away, and then they stay up for 3 straight days reading the thing, and this somehow is something we want to discourage, that we want to inhibit in some fashion. So, the Harry Potter books, I think, have a special, really special place. Is there anything else on that list that has that same kind of power as a cultural force?
Well, you could potentially make that argument about James Patterson, that there are adults who that's what they choose to read for enjoyment, for relaxation, for escapism. And it's maybe
the difference is J.K. Rowling can write and she writes her own books.
But I think
I know I just started something.
I think if we want to be encouraging people to read and thinking about all the different things that reading can bring, all the different benefits of reading, that there is something to be said for that recreational escapism aspect of a novel. I almost said a good novel, but I won't qualify it that way. There's possibly that argument to be made also for having those kinds of titles on the list.
Well, and I could have seen, like, for example, in that sort of genre, Lee Child's books are very well written, similar in theme. Or you could have gone back to, John D. MacDonald or even any of the Robert Parkers or Ross MacDonald. I don't think Raymond Chandler made the list either, did he? So anyhow, we have gotten an email from a listener named Allison. If you want to join the conversation by email, you can do so by sending us your email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Allison writes, apparently Americans are not supposed to be reading nonfiction. After scoring 22 on the list, most books having been read in school, I am told I am encouraged to read. I read. I read a lot. I read nonfiction. Just finished The Evolution of Beauty by Prum. Is it Prum or Prum? Don't know. And we'll be discussing Why We Sleep by Walker at my book club this month, or next month. This month, we discussed Fagan's Time Detectives. How about doing a nonfiction list of 100 for Great American Read next year? Good idea or bad idea, Lisa?
Well, I was actually not going to bring it up, but I'm glad she had the nerve to. I was wondering why there wasn't at least one nonfiction book on there just for that purpose, because we have a lot of people at our library, a lot of our patrons who devour nonfiction, and I felt like they would feel left out like Allison does. And that kind of hurt me just a little bit. And the other thing that hurt me just a little bit was there wasn't a children's book. I mean, a true children's book on there, whether it was Winnie the Pooh or something, only because of how it resonates. And, you know, people who are illiterate and learn later in life how to read, that could be a very important book for them, even though it's been banned before. But those were my two questions was, why wasn't there a nonfiction? And why wasn't there a children's book that's a classic or at least timeless in some way?
I think The closest thing that I saw on the list was Hatchet to a children's book, which is close, but it's not quite there yet as far as, you know, there are a lot of classic children's books out there that would have been great, not only for, you know, new readers and things like that, but just for children's books are awesome. I don't know if you've read a children's book lately. I have a 2.5-year-old son. And there are some picture books out there that tell an amazing story in a really interesting way. But to the point of the person who emailed, I firmly agree a nonfiction list is highly needed. I'm a nonfiction reader, and nonfiction gets the short shrift. There are some sharp, sharp writers out there telling really good stories that are true and that are based in something like science that I think people could get into if we made a list.
All right, so we'll start one right here then. Pick one nonfiction book that you think should be on a list if we did that. I'll start with Everybody's Avoiding Eye Contact again, but I'm going to pick on Christy.
I will tell you I am almost exclusively a fiction reader, but recently read Killers of the Flower Moon when it was picked for the PBS NewsHour book club, and found that to be an amazing story, amazing writing. Very, very thought-provoking, very discussable title that would be one that I would like to see on a list like that.
John?
The nonfiction book that I always recommend to anybody who claims to not like nonfiction is A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson.
Yeah.
It's one of the funniest books I've ever read of fiction.
Any of Bill Bryson's books.
Exactly. But that's his masterpiece, in my opinion. And so that's where I always send people if they're looking for a toehold in nonfiction.
Lisa?
That's a harder one for me because I tend to read nonfiction based on what I need at the moment. And since I'm a caregiver for someone with Alzheimer's, I'm thinking of all these Alzheimer's titles, which would not be the best to be there. But maybe something along the lines, it was made into a movie, and I could see the picture and I can't, but it was about the women engineers in NASA.
Oh,
Hidden Figures.
I think that had a little bit of fiction in it. She had to fictionalize a little bit, but it was mostly based, it was almost strictly nonfiction based on her reports and how she wrote it. Had that kind of bridgy gap of nonfiction fiction. But that one I think was great because it just showed women and minorities in STEM.
We are talking about the Great American Read today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. And I see there's a fair discussion going on Twitter right now, really about, for lack of a better term, book monogamy. We'll get into that when we come back. My guests are Indy Library Director of Public Services John Helling, Carmel librarian Christy Walker, and Lisa Phipps of the Kokomo Library. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the Great American Read today on No Limits, the launch show of which is on WFYI 1 TV on the TV side. Tonight at, looks like, I do not have a time. You'll have to check the schedule. All the information, though, you can find on our website at WFYI.org, including, I might add, links to the list so that you can start voting and having these arguments, not just with us, but with your family members as well. So the Twitter discussion here that is going on, and I should say, if my guests are Indy Library Director of Public Services John Helling, Carmel Librarian Christy Walker, and Kokomo Librarian Lisa Phipps, are from listeners saying, basically asking about reading more than one book at once, that some of them say that if when they ask what they're reading, if they say that, well, actually there's several of them, they're being judged. One said, added the hashtag polygamy, but with books. And others say, I bounce between multiple books. I usually have a nonfiction and a fiction going. And what I choose to read depends on my mood. If you want to join that conversation, you can find us on Twitter at NoLimitsWFYI. Christy, how common is that?
There is no shame in that whatsoever. I think you can never have too many books going at one time, especially in different formats. I'm the kind of person that likes to have at least one book in print going at a time and an audio book on my phone that I'm listening to in the car and listening to while doing dishes and folding laundry. I think it's nice to be able to dip into different kinds of books at the same time. Sometimes you're in the mood for one thing, sometimes you're in the mood for something else, and that's one of the joys of public libraries, too, is that we can make that possible without too much of a dent in your wallet.
I wholeheartedly agree because, like I said a little minute ago, I'm a co-caregiver for my mother who has Alzheimer's, and so I spend a lot of time at my place and a lot of time at her place. I've got books on the nightstand there and books on the nightstand here, and then I've got, you know, my e-readers, and it depends. If she's had a hard day, I'm not going to go for the hard read. I'm going to go for the easy read. So I'm all about, I am not monogamous with books. I will be a proud supporter of polygamy on that support.
I think it's unanimous. Book polygamy is okay.
Yes.
Do e-readers make that to some degree easier? Not to mention the fact, you know, when I travel now, it is so much easier just to slip that thing into my briefcase than to carry the 300 pounds of books that I would take with me everywhere. And then inevitably, because I always bought more when I was traveling, have to find a post office somewhere to ship them back to my home, the ones that I'd already read. Have we found that e-readers seem to be changing people's habits so that it makes it easier for them to bounce back?
I think so, definitely. As someone who was stuck on an international trip once with a large book that is on the Great American Read list that I will not mention by name that I really did not enjoy, and that was the book I was stuck on the trip with, and did not at that point have access to e-books, I think that e-books do allow you to carry a whole library in your pocket, which is a wonderful thing.
I think audiobooks are the other thing that makes more people polygamous these days, because they have that going on their car, or like you said, when they're in their laundry room or whatever. I think that really adds to polygamy these days.
We should emphasize this is literary bookish polygamy.
Yeah, here. That's a whole other channel. Yeah. To talk about polygamy.
We've gotten a comment from a listener named Caroline on Facebook. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can do so. Find us at No Limits WFYI. Caroline writes, I read War and Peace in the summer after my freshman high school year. I couldn't put it down. Action, adventure, romance, plus the added benefit that in the summer I was able to see the Russian movie production of the novel. I'm always curious, Caroline, though. I read War and Peace, too. It's been probably 20 years or more, and was caught up in it, too, until you get to the very end, which is this long kind of philosophic essay on the forces of history and the nature of war and, you know, basically the flaws in humanity. And I've long thought, okay, why didn't he just stop when the story ended? John, you look like you want to say something.
I think a lot of those books could have benefited from a good editor, some of those masters.
Well, they got paid by the word.
That's true. They must have. I think that's one of the, just to take a half step back, one of the benefits of book polygamy. If you're reading a book like War and Peace and you get to a dry stretch, dip out for a second and read a graphic novel and then come back, and it kind of refreshes you, so it doesn't start to feel like a slog and it doesn't start to feel like a chore.
We've gotten a comment on Facebook from our WFYI's own All Things Considered host, Matt Pelzer, who says, speaking of Bill Bryson, one of my favorite authors, A Short History of Nearly Everything is one of the best nonfiction books I've ever read, period. Broad, informative, and at times howlingly funny. That's part of the joy. I remember my first exposure to Bill Bryson was reading his first book about Great Britain. I think it's Notes from a Small Island. And at the time, my then fiance, who is my wife now, and I were getting ready. We were planning our honeymoon in the UK, and I read the book to prepare for that. And, you know, she thought obviously I was doing research, and all of a sudden she just hears these whoops of laughter from the other room and said, why aren't you focused, basically? Why? And I had to explain to her just how funny the guy was. We've also gotten an email from a listener named Christopher. If you want to join the conversation by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Are there any titles by Terry Pratchett on the list? He is such a fantastic satirist and one of the most insightful authors you could encounter, considering that he works in both humor and fantasy, two oft-maligned genres. Thanks. Christy.
There isn't one on the list, but I would agree. And I think that's those kinds of conversations are interesting, too. And looking at the list, I think as librarians, we look at this list and we sometimes are immediately making the kinds of connections that we make at work with library patrons, thinking about if you like Terry Pratchett, who are some other authors or other titles that you would enjoy. Same thing with some of these titles on the list, that we're thinking about those connections and how a list like this, or having a particular title that's a favorite, can really extend your reach into literature and to reading in general.
And just to back up just a second, when you're talking about humor in nonfiction, I think that just goes to quality of writing. Mm-hmm. Because you can have any topic, nonfiction or fiction, and be a great writer and make people laugh or cry or anything. So I think that, like this shows with this author, I know that his science fiction, right? He doesn't do
Terry Pratchett. More,
yeah, it's more. Yeah,
okay. My niece, who's dyslexic, she reads anything he writes. So it's interesting to me that, you know, he can write two ways, but he can still attract varied readers. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a good sign of a good writer and therefore a good book.
Which raises another question. For each one of you, what's the greatest omission on this list? Who's the one writer that each one of you absolutely loves that didn't make this list and should have? I'll start with John.
I will say, for me, this is a very, you know, I don't expect necessarily many people to agree with this, but I think Alexander Solzhenitsyn is one of the most criminally underappreciated writers. Mm-hmm. Even though he is appreciated, I think he's still underappreciated for what he did. And the book that I would most like to see people try and to be included in things like this is The First Circle, which is his gigantic War and Peace sized novel of life inside the gulag in the 60s. That he, you know, of course, experienced as a human before he got out and wrote these books. So, The First Circle by Alexander Solzhenitsyn should be on there.
Okay. How about you, Lisa?
I'm going to go back to something we were talking about during the break, and that's Laura Ingalls Wilder, because I think that there are few children in this world, maybe not now, but at least in my generation and above, that wasn't affected by her writing as a child. And, you know, she has awards named after her. And I think I was happy to see Anne of Green Gables, but I would have preferred a Laura Ingalls Wilder book on there.
Christy.
An author I would have liked to see, although I'm not surprised that she isn't on the list because this is a more obscure author, is Dorothy Dunnett, who writes a couple of series or wrote a couple of series of historical novels that are just wonderful. My favorite is the Lyman Chronicles that are set in 16th century Scotland. Very dense, very rich historical novels. They're actually something that if you're looking to make those connections with readers, people who enjoy Game of Thrones and the density and richness and action of those novels, that would be an author that I might recommend to them. Dorothy Dunnett, Game of Kings, ironically, is the name of the first title in that series.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about The Great American Read, the premiere of which is on WFYI 20.1 tonight from 8 to 10 p.m. Hope you will tune in. If you want to join this conversation, you have a couple of ways you can do that. You can call us at several ways, actually, 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. And even after we go on the air, apparently the conversation is going to continue on our Facebook page, so all of you can continue to weigh in there. We've gotten an email from our regular listener named Jerry, who's going to take me to task. I knew I was going to pay for this. Jerry sent us an email, and anyone else can do so by sending the email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, "I was going just to listen, but when you diss the final 50 pages of War and Peace, I just had to comment. How can you not make the comparison between the autocratic Napoleon and certain contemporary political leaders?" Okay. All right. Fair point. Fair point, Jerry. I'm just saying that after all that preceded it, which I found to be incredibly stirring and involving and was captured, to suddenly be treated to an essay at the end was a little bit of a come down. But you make a reasonable point, Jerry. So we probably ought to talk we've gotten a tweet from a listener named Libby. Again, you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. It says, "There are too many books to count that they've read over and over again. Grapes of Wrath, Great Gatsby, The Fountainhead, Pride and Prejudice, just to name a few." Is that part of the beauty of this, too, is that, you know, books ultimately do? I think John mentioned that you reread Lord of the Rings every year. For me, that's great. The Great Gatsby. I try to read that at least once a year because I think that is the most exquisitely, perfectly written novel in the American canon. But, you know, is that part of it, too, is that these books that have become our companions through the years show up on these lists, too? Christy.
I certainly think so. And I think that you bring something different to a book depending on what point you're reading it in your life. A series that I go back to, much like John does with The Lord of the Rings, are The Chronicles of Narnia, which I have in the paperback box set with the weird 1978 covers. But just reading those books as an adult is completely different from reading them as a 10-year-old when I would check them out of the library. But even the experience of holding a copy of a book in my hand that looks like the book that I read when I was 10 years old is very special.
Lisa.
I'm the same way. And as soon as she said that, it's the touch of the book when you're holding it in your hand, and it brings back that flood of memories of when you read it when you were 10, when you were 17. And each time you look forward to it, it's like a little gift that you want to just slowly unwrap and go, oh, here we go again. And the one on the list for me would be The Sun Also Rises. But just every time I see it on my bookshelf and I grab it, I just have that feeling of, or like I'm home, you know, with my book.
John.
I'm running through the list of books that I feel the need to revisit over and over, and I'm thinking, man, I need to really try some new books because there are a lot that I read over and over. I think The Pastors of Heaven by John Steinbeck might be to substitute for The Great Gatsby as the most beautifully written book in the English language. I think that would be it. But I don't, you know, like everyone said, I don't think there's any shame in that because you do bring something new to it every time and you get something fresh out of it and you experience it differently. So I think it's okay to keep digging at something like that.
We've heard from another listener via Twitter. And again, if you want to track us down on Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. This listener writes, "The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks is an amazing nonfiction read. And the only books, and no, the only books I read all at the same time are textbooks," laughing out loud.
I should have said that one, because that one is an amazing book that our book discussion groups have devoured every time. It's an amazing book.
I suspect that we're anticipating Great American Read 2.0. I would not be surprised to see a nonfiction version in the future.
Mm-hmm. In the next year. That gets a little trickier, though, because some nonfiction tends to date a little more. So we're getting close on time here. We probably ought to loop back to ways people can plug in to the Great American Read using their local libraries as reference points. I'll start with Lisa on that one.
I think the biggest thing is just to talk to your librarian and go over the list and talk to him or her and say, you know, here are some of my favorites on the list. I'm not sure why some of these others are on there. What do you think about them? And open up that discussion, because librarians love to talk about books. So they can help you. And they can say, if you loved The Great Gatsby, here are some others that you might be surprised by why they're on this list, but they would be good for you.
Christy.
I'd say be inspired by the list. Look for the gaps in your own list and go back and read some of these titles. I'm certainly interested to go and pick up some of the 49 that I haven't taken a crack at yet.
So what's the first one?
Their Eyes Were Watching God.
Okay.
That's one I've been interested in reading for a while, haven't gotten around to, and probably number two will be A Confederacy of Dunces after all the turmoil about that earlier in this discussion.
Well, as I say, beer and Cajun food help quite a bit. John.
I don't really have much to add, except for the library can help you do whatever it is that you want to do and read whatever it is that you want to read. And if you don't see something you like, tell us what you do like, and we'll give you something else that's based on that.
And it's probably all of these books are available at the libraries, right?
So I would be hard-pressed to not find these on our...
Exactly. And if we don't have it, we'll get it for you from someone else.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Interlibrary loan.
That's right.
Available to read and to listen to.
Yes.
Multiple formats.
Okay.
Yes.
So out of this, the takeaway for Christy is that she's going to eat Cajun food and drink a little beer and read A Confederacy of Dunces.
Absolutely.
John, what are you going to do?
I'm going to give War and Peace another shot. You know, I've heard so much good about it today. Why not?
You'll make Jerry happy. Lisa?
I think I'm going to have to go War and Peace back to it, because it's been a while since I tried it. So I just won't be doing it on the tough days.
Well, that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Indy Library Director of Public Services, John Helling, Carmel Librarian Christy Walker, and Lisa Phipps from the Kokomo Library for what's been a lively conversation about books and writers and just the love of reading in celebration of the Great American Read, which premieres tonight on WFYI 20.1 at 8 p.m. Also like to thank our listeners and invite them back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about women in motorsports. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting station.